You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma, Collected Works, Volume 120, given in Hamburg from the 16th to the 28th of May, 1910. Lecture 1, entitled The Nature and Significance of Karma in Humanity, the Earth, and the Universe, given in Hamburg on the 16th of May, 1910. In this cycle of lectures, we will deal with various questions of spiritual science, which are extremely important to our lives. As I have already pointed out on many occasions, spiritual science is not an abstract theory, a mere doctrine or teaching. It is a source of life and fitness for life, and fulfills its task only when the knowledge it can impart pours something into our souls which makes life richer, enhances our understanding of life, and makes us more competent and effective. This is something you will all be familiar with. However, if you look around you to find out how such ideals might be applied in life, you might feel disheartened. For if we consider impartially what the world thinks it, in quotes, knows today, and what makes people feel or act in one way or another today, we might well conclude that all of this is much too far removed from anthroposophical ideas and ideals for the anthroposophist to influence life directly by what he has acquired from spiritual science. Yet such a view would be rather superficial, since it takes no account of what we ourselves need to learn. If the forces we develop through anthroposophy really do become sufficiently strong, they will find ways of working in the world. Whereas if no efforts were ever made to strengthen these forces, it would be impossible to make a difference in the world. But there is something else which may comfort us when we are in danger of losing heart, and this is the very purpose of what I am going to deal with in this cycle of lectures, the subject of karma in human life, and in general. For with every hour we spend here, we shall see more clearly that there is no end to what we can do to make anthroposophy work in the world. We shall also see how karma itself will bring us what we need to do in the short or long term to develop our forces, as long as we seriously believe in it. We shall also understand the following. Whenever we believe that we cannot yet apply the forces gained from our view of the world, it is simply a question of our not having developed these forces sufficiently for karma to enable us to work in the world with them. In other words, these lectures will do more than build up a body of knowledge about karma. In every hour, our confidence in karma will be more fully awakened. And we shall have the certainty that when the time comes, be it tomorrow or the day after, or in many years' time, our karma will bring us the tasks which we, as anthroposophists, may need to perform. Karma will reveal itself to us as a teaching which not only tells us how different things in the world relate to one another, but will make our lives more satisfying and rich. But if karma is really to do this, we must go more deeply into its laws and its working in the universe. In this case, it is to a certain extent necessary that I should do something unusual for me in dealing with questions of spiritual science, namely to give a definition, an explanation of a word. I don't normally do this, as explanations of words are usually not very useful. In our considerations, we generally begin by the presentation of facts, and if these facts are grouped and arranged in the proper way, the concepts and ideas follow of themselves. But if we were to follow a similar course with regard to the comprehensive questions which we have to discuss during the next few lectures, we should need much more time than is at our disposal. So in this case, for better understanding, I must give, if not exactly a definition, at least some description of the concept which is to occupy us for some time. Definitions are for the purpose of making clear what is meant when one uses a particular word. In this way, a description of the concept of karma will be given so that we know what we are talking about when in future the word karma is used in these lectures. From various previous considerations, you will all have formed some idea of what karma is. It is a very abstract idea of karma to call it, quote, the spiritual law of causes, close quote. The law by which certain effects follow certain causes found in spiritual life. This idea of karma is too abstract, because it is on the one hand too narrow, and on the other much too comprehensive. If we wish to conceive of karma as a, quote, law of causes, close quote, we must connect it with what is otherwise known in the world as, quote, the law of causality, close quote, the law of cause and effect. Let us be clear about what we understand to be the law of causes in general before we speak of spiritual facts and events. It is very often emphasized nowadays by natural science that its actual importance lies in the fact that it is founded on the universal law of causes, and that it traces effects to their respective causes. But it is not quite so clear how this linking of cause and effect actually takes place. For you will still find in books of the present day, which are held to be scholarly works of philosophy, such expressions as the following. An effect is that which follows from a cause. But this is a gross misrepresentation of the facts. In the case of a warm sunbeam falling on a metal plate and making it warmer than before, science would speak of cause and effect in the ordinary sense. But can we claim that the effect, the warming of the metal plate, follows from the cause of the warm sunbeam? If the warm sunbeam had this effect already within it, why is it that it warms the metal plate only when it comes into contact with it? Hence, in the world of phenomena, in the inanimate world, which is all around us, it is necessary, if an effect is to follow a cause, that something should encounter this cause. Unless this takes place, one cannot speak of an effect following from a cause. This preliminary remark, philosophical and abstract though it apparently sounds, is by no means superfluous. For if real progress is to be made in anthroposophical matters, we must get into the habit of being extremely accurate in our ideas and not take the casual approach adopted sometimes in other branches of knowledge. In relation to effects like that of the sunbeam warming a sheet of metal, we should not speak of karma at all. Certainly there is causality. The connection between cause and effect is there, but we should never obtain a true idea of karma if we spoke of it only in that way. Hence, we cannot use the term karma in speaking of a simple relation between effect and cause. Let us now try and develop a more advanced concept of the connection between cause and effect. For instance, if we have a bow and we bend it and shoot off an arrow with it, an effect is caused by the bending of the bow. But we can no more speak of the effect of the shot arrow in connection with its cause as karma than in the foregoing case. But if we consider something else in connection with this process, we shall, to a certain extent, get nearer to the idea of karma, even if we still do not quite grasp it. For example, we may reflect that the bow, if often bent, becomes slack in time. So from what the bow does and from what happens to it, there will follow not only an effect which shows itself externally, but also one which will react upon the bow itself. Through the frequent bending of the bow, something happens to the bow itself. Something which happens through the bending of the bow reacts, so to speak, on the bow. Thus an effect is obtained, which reacts on the object by which the effect itself was caused. This is indeed an important part of the idea of karma. You cannot speak of karma unless an effect is produced which in turn reacts upon the thing or being producing this effect. Unless there is this characteristic feature that the effect reacts upon the being who caused it. We thus get somewhat nearer to the idea when it is clear to us that the effects caused by the thing or being must recoil upon that thing or being itself. Nevertheless, we must not call the slackening of the bow through frequent bending the karma of the bow, for the following reason. If we have had the bow for 3 or 4 weeks, and have often bent it, so that after this time it becomes slack, then we really have in the slack bow something quite different from the tense bow of 4 weeks before. Thus, when the reacting effect is of such a kind that it makes the thing or the being something quite different, we cannot yet speak of karma. We may speak of karma only when the effects which react upon a being find the same being to react upon, or at any rate that being in a certain sense unaltered. Thus, we have come again a little nearer to the idea of karma. But if we describe it in this way, we obtain only a very abstract conception of it. If we want to grasp this idea abstractly, we cannot do better than by expressing it in the way we have just done. But one thing more must be added to this idea of karma. If the effect reacts upon the being immediately, that is, if cause and reacting effect are simultaneous, we can hardly speak of karma. For in this case, the being from whom the effect proceeded would have actually intended to bring about that result directly. He would, therefore, foresee the effect and would perceive all the elements leading to it. When this is the case, we really cannot speak of karma. For instance, we cannot speak of karma in the case of a person performing an act by which he intends to bring about certain results, and who then obtains the desired result in accordance with his purpose. That is to say, between the cause and the effect, there must be something hidden from the person when he sets the cause in motion. So that though this connection is really there, it was not actually designed by the person himself. If this connection has not been intended by him, then the reason for a connection between cause and effect must be looked for elsewhere than in the intentions of the person in question. That is to say, this reason must be determined by a certain fixed law. Thus, karma also includes the fact that the connection between cause and effect is determined by a law independent of whether or not there be direct intention on the part of the being concerned. We have now grouped together a few principles which may help us to form a clearer picture of what karma is. All of these principles must be part of our concept of karma, and we must not limit ourselves to an abstract definition, or else we shall not be able to comprehend the manifestations of karma in the different spheres of the world. We must now first seek for the manifestations of karma where we first meet with them, in individual human lives. Can we find anything of the sort in individual lives? And when can we find what we have just presented in our explanation of the concept of karma? We should find something of the sort if, for example, we experienced something in our life about which we could say, this experience which has come to us is related in a particular way to an earlier experience of ours, which we caused ourselves. Let us try, in the first place, by mere observation of life, to determine whether this relationship exists. We will take the purely external point of view. Without it, we shall never understand the laws by which events and experiences in life are related, any more than someone who has never observed the collision of two billiard balls can understand the elasticity which makes them rebound. Observation of life can lead us to the perception of a law of interdependence. Let us take a definite example. Suppose that a young man in his 19th year, who by some accident is obliged to give up a profession which until then had seemed to be marked out for him, and who, up to that time, had pursued a course of study to prepare him for that profession, through some misfortune to his parents, was compelled to give up this profession, and at the age of 18 to become a businessman. If we observe such incidents in life completely objectively, like one would observe the impact of billiard balls in physics, we might find, for example, that the experience of the business life into which the young man was driven is a stimulating one at first, that he fulfills his duties, learns something, and perhaps even makes quite a success out of this career. At the same time, one might observe that something very different sets in after a while, a certain malaise, a feeling of discontent. If the change of career took place at 18 years of age, the next few years may pass inconspicuously. Yet, around the 23rd year, perhaps, it might become apparent that something had taken root in his soul, something quite inexplicable. Looking more closely into the matter, we are likely to find, if the case is not complicated, that the explanation of the boredom arising 5 years after the change of calling must be sought for in his 13th or 14th year, for the causes of such a phenomenon are generally to be sought for at about the same period of time before the change of calling, as the occurrence we have been describing took place after that change. The man in question, when he was a schoolboy of 13, 5 years before the change of vocation, might have experienced something in his soul which gave him a feeling of inner happiness. Supposing that no change of profession had taken place, then that to which the youth had accustomed himself in his 13th year would have been fulfilled in later life and would have borne fruit. Then, however, came the change which at first interested the young man and engaged his soul. Something entered his soul life which repressed what had occupied it before. It is possible to repress something for a certain time, but through the very fact of being repressed it gains a special force, especially inwardly. An elastic force, as it were, is built up in the soul. This might be compared with the squeezing of an india rubber ball, which we can compress to a certain point where it resists, and if it were allowed to spring back, it would do so in proportion to the force with which we have just compressed it. In like manner, experiences like the one just described, what the young man experienced in his soul in his 13th year had consolidated by the time the change of career came along, can also be repressed in a certain way. But then, after a while, resistance arises in the soul. Then one can see how this resistance grows to finally show its effect. Because the soul lacks something it would have if the change of career had not taken place, that which had been repressed emerges and manifests as discontent and boredom with life. So this is a case where the person concerned experienced something, did something in his 13th, 14th year, and did something else later, that is, changed his career, and we can see how these causes show their effect later on, by reacting upon the same person. In a case like this, we should have to apply the concept of karma to an individual human life. Now, one ought not to object, but we have known of cases where nothing of the kind was shown. That may well be. Yet it would not occur to a physicist examining the laws of velocity of a falling stone to say that the law would not be valid if the stone was deflected by a blow. We need to learn to observe properly and exclude all phenomena which do not affect the establishing of the law concerned. Surely, such an individual who, if nothing else intervened, experiences the effects of impressions in his 13th year in the form of boredom in his 23rd year would not experience this particular boredom if he had married in the meantime, for example. But such an occurrence has no bearing on the establishment of the fundamental law. What is important is that we find the right factors which will lead us to a particular law. Observation in itself is nothing. Only methodical observation will enable us to understand the law. With the study of the law of karma, we must apply such methodical observation in the right way. Now, let us assume, for the purpose of establishing the karma of a particular individual, that this person suffered a heavy blow of destiny in his 25th year. This event caused him pain and suffering. If we confine our observations to simply stating that this heavy blow of destiny broke in upon this life and filled it with pain and suffering, in other words, if we do not go beyond the mere observation, we shall never understand karmic connections. But if we go further and examine the life of such an individual who in his 25th year experienced that stroke of destiny, in his 50th year we might arrive at a view such as this one. The person we are looking at has developed into a virtuous and hard-working individual, well established in life. Now we look back over his life, and we find that at the age of 20 he was still a good-for-nothing, with no initiative at all. Then, at the age of 25, a severe blow of destiny hit him. If this blow had not hit him, we may now say, he would have remained a good-for-nothing character. In other words, the heavy blow of destiny was the cause of the virtue and competence manifest in the individual's 50th year. Such facts also teach us that we should be mistaken if we consider the blow of destiny in the 25th year as mere effect. For if we ask ourselves what the stroke of destiny caused, we must go beyond mere observation. But if we consider the blow not as effect at the end of the phenomena which preceded it, but place it rather at the beginning of the subsequent events, and consider it as a cause, we will find that even our feelings in relation to this blow of destiny may change substantially. We shall very likely be grieved if we think of it only as an effect, but if we think of it as the cause of what happens later on, we shall probably be glad and feel pleasure over it. For we can say that thanks to the fateful blow, the man who experienced it has become a decent human being. So we see that our attitude is essentially different in so far as we consider an event in life as cause or as effect. It matters a great deal whether we consider what happens in life as mere effect or as cause. It is true that if we start our investigations at the time of the painful event, we cannot then clearly perceive the direct effect. But if we have arrived at the law of karma by the observation of similar cases, that law can itself say to us, an event is painful perhaps now, because it appears to us merely as the result of what has happened previously. But it can also be looked upon as the starting point of what is to follow. Then we can foresee the blow of fate as the starting point and the cause of the results. And this places the matter in quite a different light. Thus the law of karma itself may be a source of consolation if we accustom ourselves to set an event not only at the end, but at the beginning of a series of events. It is important that we learn to study life methodically and to place things in the right relationship to one another as cause and effect. If we carry out these observations thoroughly, we shall notice events in the life of a person which take place with a certain regularity. Others, again, appear quite irregularly in the same life. In this way, you will be able to discover remarkable connections in human life, provided that you observe it properly. And this involves looking further than the end of your nose. Unfortunately, the phenomena of human life are only observed over short spans of time at present, no more than a few years at most. And people are not in a habit of relating what happened after many years to earlier events which might well have caused the later. That is why there are very few people today capable of establishing a certain connection between the beginning and the end of human life. Yet this connection is extraordinarily instructive. Supposing we have brought up a child during the first 7 years of life without ever assuming, as it is generally assumed, that if an individual is to lead a good and useful life, he must conform to our own standards of what makes a person good and useful. For in that case, we would be keen to train the child strictly in everything we consider essential to being good and useful. Whereas, if we recognize at the outset that one can be good and useful in many different ways, and that there is no need to determine in which of these ways the child, with his individual talents, is to become a good and useful human being, we would say, whatever may be my ideas of a good and useful person, this child is to become one through having his best talents brought out, and these I must first discover. What matter the rules by which I myself feel bound? The child himself must feel the need to do what he does. If I wish to develop the child according to his individual talents, I must try to develop tendencies latent in him and draw them out, so that he may above all realize them and act in accordance with them. This shows us that there are two quite different ways of influencing a child in the first 7 years of his life. If we now look at the child in his later life, it will be a long time before the essential effects are manifested of what we have in this way brought into the first years of his life. Observation of life reveals to us that the actual effects of what was put into the child's soul in his earliest years as causes do not manifest until the very evening of life. A person may possess to the very end of his life an active mind if he has been, as a child, educated in this way. That is, if the living, inherent tendencies of his soul have been observed and naturally developed. If we have drawn out and developed his innate powers, we shall see the fruits in the evening of his life, displayed as a rich soul life. On the other hand, in a starved and impoverished soul, and a correspondingly weak old age, for we shall see later on how a starved soul reacts on the body, is manifested what we have done wrong in our treatment of a person in earliest childhood. This is something in human life which, in a certain way, is so regular that it is applicable to everyone as a connection between cause and effect. The same connection may also be found in the intermediate stages of life, and I will deal with this in due course. The way in which we treat a child from his 7th to his 14th year produces effects in that part of his life which precedes the final stage, and thus we see cause and effect working in cycles. What existed as cause in the earliest years comes out as effect in the latest ones. But in addition to these causes and effects in individual lives, which run their course in cycles, there is what may be described as a straight line law. In our example, which showed how the 13th year influenced the 23rd, we see how cause and effect are so connected with human life that what a person has experienced leads to after effects, which in their turn react upon him. Thus, karma is fulfilled in individual lives. However, if we only search for the connection between causes and effects in one life of a particular human being, we shall not arrive at an explanation of human life in general. We will develop this thought further in the next few sessions. I am only pointing out something you are already familiar with from the teachings of spiritual science, that human life between birth and death is the repetition of earlier human lives. If we now seek for the chief characteristic of the life between birth and death, we can describe this as being the extension of one and the same consciousness, essentially at least, throughout the entire period between birth and death. If you call to mind the earliest parts of your life, you will say, there is indeed a point of time when my recollections of life begin, which does not coincide with my birth, but which comes somewhat later. With the exception of initiates, this is how people experience this. They refer to their consciousness as reaching back to just that point. There is indeed something very remarkable in the period of time between birth and the beginning of this recollection of life, and we shall return to it again, as it will throw light upon important matters. Except, then, for this period between birth and the beginning of memory, we can say that life between birth and death is characterized by the fact of one consciousness extending throughout that period of time. Normally, people do not look for the causes of what happened to them later in life in earlier periods of their life. Yet it would be possible to find such connections if sufficient attention were paid and if all possible aspects were properly investigated. When we use the consciousness we all have in the form of our memory consciousness and try to place before our soul the connection between earlier and later events in the karmic sense, we might say, for example, I can see that certain things that have happened to me might not have happened if this or that event had not taken place earlier in my life. Or else, now I am paying for what my earlier upbringing has done to me. Even if all you achieve is understanding a certain connection between the wrong others have caused in you through the way you were brought up and certain events in your later life, it will be helpful to an extent. It is easier than to find ways and means of counteracting the early harm suffered. Indeed, recognizing such connections between causes and effects in the different periods of our life, which we can contemplate with our ordinary consciousness, can be of very great benefit. For if we attain such knowledge, we may accomplish something else too. Naturally, when someone at the age of 80 looks back over his life to find the causes of events in his 80th year, in his earliest childhood, he may find it difficult to find ways of compensating for what he suffered then. And even if he did go about it in the right manner, it would not help him a great deal. But if he takes the right approach before and looks back in, say, his 40th year on the wrongs that have been done to him, he might then have time to take measures against them. Thus we see that it is desirable to reach beyond our immediate life, karma, and attain to an understanding of the laws of karma. This may be very useful in our life. What should a person do who, in his 40th year, attempts to avert the effect of wrongs done to him, or wrongs which he himself did in his 12th year? He will do everything to avert the consequences of his own misdeeds or those of others toward him. He will, to a certain extent, replace by another the effect which would inevitably have arisen had he not intervened. The knowledge of what happened in his 12th year will lead him to a definite action in his 40th year, which he would not have taken unless he had known what it was that had happened in his 12th year. What then has the man done by looking back at his early life? He has applied his consciousness to make a certain effect follow a certain cause. He has willed the effect and has brought it about. This shows us how, in the line of karmic consequences, our will can intervene and bring about something which takes the place of the karmic effects which would otherwise have followed. If we consider such a case in which a person has quite consciously brought about a connection between cause and effect in life, we could conclude that in this case karma, or the laws of karma, have penetrated his consciousness, and he has himself in a certain way brought about the karmic effect. Let us now apply what we know about the repeated earth lives of a human being to such a picture. The consciousness of which we have just spoken, which extends, with the exception mentioned, throughout the period between birth and death, is due to the fact that the human being is able to use his brain as an instrument. When we pass through the gate of death, a different sort of consciousness comes into play, one that is independent of the brain and works under completely different conditions. We also know that this consciousness, which extends up to the point of our next birth, experiences a sort of review of everything we have done in our life between our last birth and death. In this period between birth and death, we must first form the intention to look back at any wrongs which have been done to us or which we have done, if we wish to counteract these wrongs karmically. After death, in looking back over life, we see what we have done wrong or otherwise, and at the same time we see how these deeds have affected us. We see how a certain deed of ours has improved or debased us. If we have brought suffering to anyone, we have sunk and become of less value. We are less perfect, so to speak. Now, if we look back after death, we see numerous events of the sort, and we say to ourselves, through this I have become less perfect. Then in the consciousness after death, the will and power arise to win back, when the opportunities occur, the value we have lost. The will, that is to say, to make compensation for every wrong committed. Thus, between death and a new birth, the tendency and intention is formed to make good what has been done wrong, in order to regain the state of perfection appropriate to the human being, which has been compromised by the respective deed. Then we return once more to life on earth. Our consciousness changes again. We do not recollect the time between death and rebirth, or the resolutions to make compensation. But the intention remains within us. And although we do not know that we must do such and such a thing to compensate for such and such an act, yet we are impelled by the power within us to make the compensation. We can form an idea of what happens when someone in his 20th year encounters some great suffering. With the consciousness he possesses between birth and death, he will be dejected by his suffering. But if he could remember his resolutions made between death and a new birth, he would also be able to feel the power which drove him into the position where he was able to encounter this suffering, because he felt that only by passing through it would he win back the degree of perfection which he has lost and was now to regain. When, therefore, the ordinary consciousness says, "The trial is there, and you are suffering from it," it sees only the trouble itself and not the effect it produces. but the other consciousness, which can look back upon all the time between death and a new birth, sees the intentional seeking for the suffering or other misfortune. This is indeed what we find when we look at human life from a higher point of view. Then we can see that fateful events occur in human life, which are not the results of causes in the individual life itself, but are the effects of causes perceived in another state of consciousness, namely the consciousness we had before our birth. If we grasp these ideas thoroughly, we shall see that in the first place we have a consciousness which extends over the time between birth and death, which we call the consciousness of the individual person. And then we see that there is a consciousness which works beyond birth and death, of which man in his ordinary consciousness knows nothing, but which nevertheless works in the same way as the ordinary consciousness. We have, therefore, shown first of all how someone may take on his own karma, and in his 40th year make some compensation, so that the causes of his 12th year may not come to effect. This is a way of taking karma into one's individual personal consciousness. In the case, however, where someone is driven to suffer pain in order to compensate for something and to become a better human being, this also proceeds from the person himself, not from his personal consciousness, but from a more comprehensive consciousness which encompasses the time between death and a new birth. That being in us which is encompassed by this later consciousness we will call the individuality. And the consciousness which is being continually interrupted by the personal consciousness we will call the individual consciousness. Thus we see karma working in relation to the individual human being. In spite of this, we shall not understand human life if we only follow the sequence of phenomena as we have just done, if we only fix our attention on the causes that lie within us and the effects we seek as a result, all of which concern our own individual being. We need only bring forward a simple case to make things clearer, and we shall at once see that we cannot understand human life if we take into consideration only what has already been said. Let us take a discoverer or an inventor, Columbus, for example, or the inventor of the steam engine, or any others. In the discovery there is a distinct action, a distinct achievement. If we examine the action and seek for the cause why the person did it, we shall always find such causes by searching along the lines just pointed out. We shall find in his individual and personal karma the reasons why Columbus sailed to America and why he determined to do so at just that particular time. But now we might ask if the cause must be sought for only in his personal and individual karma. And is the action only to be considered as an effect for the individuality working in Columbus? That Columbus discovered America had certain consequences for him. He rose by doing so and became more perfect, and this will show itself in the development of his individuality in succeeding lives. But what effects has this achievement had on other people? Must it not also be considered as a cause which affected the lives of countless human beings? This again is still rather an abstract consideration of such a question, which we can grasp much more deeply by looking at human life over long periods of time. Let us consider human life in the Egyptian Chaldean age, which preceded the Greco-Latin. If we examine this age in relation to what it imparted to human beings and what they experienced at that time, we shall find something very peculiar. If we compare this epoch with our own, we shall perceive that what is happening in our own time is connected with what happened in the Egyptian Chaldean civilization. The Greco-Latin lies between the two. In our time, certain things would not happen unless other things had happened in the Egyptian Chaldean times. The scientific achievements of today are equally derived from powers which have developed in the human soul. However, the human souls who worked in our time were also incarnated in the Egyptian Chaldean age, and at that time they underwent certain experiences without which they would not be able to accomplish what they do today. If the pupils of the ancient Egyptian temple priests had not learned in Egyptian astrology about the relations existing between the heavenly bodies, they would not later on have been able to penetrate into the secrets of the world. Nor would certain souls in the present age have possessed the abilities to explore the regions of the heavens. For instance, how did Kepler arrive at his discoveries? He did so because within him there was a soul who, in the Egyptian Chaldean epoch, had acquired the forces necessary for the discoveries which he was to make in the fifth epoch. It fills us with inner satisfaction to see in certain souls memories arising, as it were, that the seeds of their present deeds were laid in the past. Kepler, one of the men who has played a most important part in the investigation of the laws of the universe, said of himself, quote, "Yes, it is I who have robbed the golden vessels of the Egyptians, to make an offering to my God, far removed from Egyptian bounds. If you will forgive me, I will rejoice, but if you blame me, I must bear it. Here I throw the dice, and I write this book. What matter if it is read today or later, even if centuries must elapse before it is read? God himself had to wait 6,000 years for the one who recognized his work." Close quote. Here we have a sporadic memory rising in Kepler of what he received as a germ for the work which he, in his personal life as Kepler, accomplished. Hundreds of similar cases might be given. But we see in Kepler something more than the mere manifestation of effects which were the result of causes in a previous incarnation. We see a manifestation which has its significance for the whole of mankind, a manifestation of something which was equally important for humanity in a previous epoch. We see how a person is placed in a special position in order to do something for the whole of mankind. We see that not only in individual lives, but in the whole of humanity, there are connections between cause and effect which stretch over wide periods of time. And we can deduce that the karmic law of the individual will intersect what we may call the karmic laws of humanity. Sometimes intersections of this kind are difficult to trace. Imagine what would have happened to our astronomy if the telescope had not been discovered at that particular time. If we look back at the history of the telescope, we see how tremendously important the discovery has been. Now, it is well known that the discovery of the telescope was made in the following way. Some children were playing with lenses in an optician's workshop, and by chance, as one might say, they had so placed the optical lenses that someone hit upon the idea of employing this arrangement to make something like a telescope. Think how deeply you must search in order to arrive at the individual karma of the children and the karma of humanity, which led to the discovery at that particular moment. Try to think the two facts out together, and you will see in what a remarkable manner the karma of single individuals and the karma of the whole of humanity intersect and weave into each other. You must admit that the whole of the development of mankind would have been different if such and such a thing had not come to pass when it did. To ask such a question as, what would have happened to the Roman Empire if the Greeks had not beaten off the Persian attack in the Persian Wars at a particular time, is often quite futile, but to ask how did it happen that the Persian War ended in this way is by no means futile. If we follow up this question and seek an answer, we shall see that in the East certain achievements only came about because there were despotic rulers who were totally self-seeking, and who, to gain their ends, joined forces with the sacrificial priests. The whole organization of the Eastern state was at that time necessary for any given thing to be accomplished, and this arrangement brought with it all the trouble which resulted in the Greeks, a differently constituted people, defeating the Eastern attack at a critical moment. How, then, must we consider the karma of those who worked in Greece to resist the Persian attack? We shall find much that is personal in the karma of those in question, but we shall also find that their personal karma is linked with the karma of nations and of humanity, so that we are justified in saying that the karma of humanity placed these particular persons in that particular place at that time. We see here the karma of humanity affecting the individual karma. And we must ask how these things are interwoven. But we may go still further and consider yet another connection. We can look back to a time in the evolution of our earth when there was as yet no mineral kingdom. The evolution of the earth was preceded by the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions, where as yet there was no mineral kingdom in our sense of the word. It was on this earth that our minerals first took on their present forms. But because the mineral kingdom became separated in the course of the earth's evolution, it will remain a separate kingdom to the end. Before that, human beings, animals, and plants had developed without the mineral kingdom, in order that later the other kingdoms might make further progress, they had to separate the mineral kingdom out of themselves. But after they had done this, they could only develop on a planet which had a firm mineral form. They could have developed in no other way than this, if we admit that the formation of a mineral kingdom took place in the way we have said. The mineral kingdom is there, and the subsequent fate of the other kingdoms depends on the existence of this mineral kingdom, which was formed within our earth in remote ages of antiquity. So, something happened, connected with the fact of the formation of the mineral kingdom, which must be taken into account in all the later evolutions of the earth. What follows as the result of the formation of the mineral kingdom finds its fulfillment in everything that comes into existence. Once again, what happened earlier will be karmically fulfilled in subsequent ages. On the earth is fulfilled what was prepared on the earth long ago. There is a connection between what happened earlier and what came to pass later, but this is also a connection which, in its effects, reacts upon the being which caused it. Human beings, animals, and plants have separated from the mineral kingdom, and the latter reacts upon them. Thus we see that it is possible to speak of the karma of the earth. Finally, we can bring to light something, the elements of which we can find in the general principles described in my book Occult Science. We know that certain beings remained behind at the stage of the Old Moon evolution, and that these beings did so for the purpose of giving to human beings certain definite qualities. Not only beings, but also substances remained from the old moon time of the earth. At the moon stage, there remained behind beings who influenced our earth's existence as luciferic beings. As a result of this, certain effects are manifested on our earth, of which the causes are to be found in the moon life. But from the point of being of actual substance, something analogous was also brought about. As we now see our solar system, we find it composed of heavenly bodies, which regularly carry out recurrent movements which display a certain inner completeness. But we find other heavenly bodies, which move indeed with a certain rhythm, but break through, as it were, the usual laws of the solar system. These are the comets. Now, the substance of a comet does not obey the laws which exist in our solar system, but such laws as prevailed in the old moon existence. Indeed, the laws of that old moon are preserved in the life of the comet. I have already often pointed out that spiritual science had provided evidence for these laws before they were confirmed by natural science. In Paris in 1906, I drew attention to the fact that during the old moon existence, certain combinations of carbon and nitrogen played a similar part to that played at the present day on our Earth by combinations of oxygen and carbon, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and so on. These latter have something deadly in them. Cyanide combinations, prussic acid combinations, played a similar part during the old moon existence. This was pointed out by spiritual science in 1906, and in other lectures it was shown that comets bring the laws of the old moon existence into our solar system, so that not only the luciferic beings remained behind, but also the laws of the old moon substance, which work in our solar system in an irregular way. We have always said that a comet must contain something like cyanide compounds in its atmosphere. Only much later, namely this year, 1910, was prussic acid found by spectrum analysis in the comet, proving what had already been made known by spiritual science. You may turn to this for evidence when people say, "Show us for once how one might actually discover something by means of spiritual science." There are other phenomena of this nature, if people would only observe them. So there is something of the old moon existence working in our present earth existence. Now we come to the question, can it be maintained that something spiritual lies behind a phenomenon observed by means of the outer senses? To one who knows spiritual science, it is quite clear that there is something spiritual behind all material realities. When something relating to substance works into our earth existence from the old moon existence, when a comet shines upon our earth, there is also something spiritual working behind it. We can even distinguish what spiritual force is working in the case of Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet is the outward expression of a new impulse of materialism every time it comes within the sphere of our Earth's existence. To the world of the present day, this may seem superstitious, but people should remember how they themselves relate spiritual influences to the constellations. Who would deny that an Eskimo is a different sort of human being from a Hindu, because in the polar regions, the sun's rays strike the Earth at a different angle? Everywhere, the scientists themselves relate spiritual effects on mankind to constellations. A spiritual impulse toward materialism is coincident with the appearance of Halley's Comet, and there is evidence of this impulse. The appearance of this comet in 1835 was followed by that materialistic culture of the second half of the 19th century, and its appearance before that was followed by the materialistic Enlightenment campaign of the French encyclopedists. That is the connection. In order that certain things may enter into the Earth's existence, the causes must be laid long before outside the Earth. This is, in fact, a case of world karma. After all, why was spiritual and material substance driven out from the old moon? In order that certain effects could react on the beings that caused this. The luciferic beings were separated off and had to develop in a different way, so that for the beings on earth, free will and the possibilities of evil could originate. Here we have something which in its karmic effect extends beyond our earth existence. Here is a glimpse of world karma. We have now dealt with the conception of karma, its significance for each personality, each individuality, and for all mankind. We have described its influence within our earth and beyond it. and we have found something else which we may describe as world karma. Thus we find the karmic law of connection between cause and effect, which works in such a way that the effect in its turn works back upon the cause, and yet, in reacting, it keeps its essence and remains the same. We find this law of karma ruling everywhere in the world, insofar as we recognize the world as spiritual in origin. We dimly sense karma revealing itself in so many different ways, in entirely different spheres, and we feel how the different branches of karma, personal karma, the karma of humanity, earth karma, world karma, and so on, will intersect each other. And we know that this is the key to understanding life, for life can only be understood in its details if we can find how the various karmic influences are interwoven. The end of Lecture 1.